Thanks, Daniel. Yeah, so I'm a graduate student at the University of Washington and Institute for Nuclear Theory. I work with David Kaplan, and for the last couple of years, I've been interested in the problem of quantum simulating lattice gauge theories. The project that I'm going to be talking about today is a work that I did with another professor at the INT, Martin Savage, and his student Natalie Klo. So I'll go ahead and jump right in. So I like to always start with, you know, what is the big picture kind of problem in theoretical physics that we're trying to solve? What are those physics targets? So simulation of quantum chromodynamics is a problem that's only accessible in limited scopes to classical computers. We would like to see hadronization in action in real time, or have a more microscopic understanding of nuclear interactions. We'd like to map out the phase diagram of QCD. Right now, we're able to access certain regimes of the phase diagram where the coupling is perturbative, but we're certainly not able to map out the whole diagram or examine the area of this proposed critical endpoint in the phase diagram using existing techniques. Then we would be able to produce the nuclear equation of state, which is an important input for nuclear astrophysics. And the way that we get these predictions for these non-perturbative problems is to use numerical simulations of quark and gluon degrees of freedom. So what does this typically look like? In this case, to do this non-perturbative simulation, one goes to a space-time lattice to numerically simulate. One, instead of using gauge fields, instead works with these so-called link variables associated with links. Here we have links extending in every space-time direction. And these link variables themselves are matrices that take values in the gauge group. So for SU3, these are just SU3 matrices associated with the links. Then a actual gauge invariant observable that you can form from these is formed by multiplying, say, four of these link variables together, going around one of these elementary plaquettes, and then finally taking the trace at the end. The action associated with that is just the sum over all possible plaquettes in the space-time lattice, added with their Hermitian conjugate, and summed over all directions. And this gives the so-called Wilson gauge action. So then with these configurations of link variables, one does Monte Carlo on them by using the exponential of the Euclidean action, which gives some probability measure that you can use for important sampling the path integral. I already said this, the relationship to the continuum gauge fields is that the gauge field is just being exponentiated in the link variables. And then as for the fermionic matter, like putting quarks into the theory, well, since the action is quadratic in those, you can integrate out the quark fields from the start. And this leads to the so-called fermion determinant, which essentially modifies what you mean by your action associated with a gauge field configuration. So using this kind of approach is great if what you're interested in is static properties of the theory or thermal equilibrium properties. But if you actually want to get at real-time dynamics, or have non-vanishing baryon density, or put a topological theta term into the Lagrangian, now the action is generically complex valued. This leads to so-called sign problems due to the fact that your exponential of the action no longer is positive definite, so it doesn't have an interpretation as a probability measure. A cartoon to get a feel for why this is such a problem is pretty easy to see. You can just take a simple Gaussian integral and artificially give it a sine problem by shifting the contour in the complex plane by 10 imaginary units. In this case, I just took 1/2 x² and shifted it by those 10 imaginary units. And then this leads to the integrand now oscillating violently with an amplitude on the order of 10 to the 21. So even though we know that this integral comes out to an order one number, one has to be able to resolve that by very delicate cancellations between contributions that are on the order of 10 to the 21. At a more practical level, one is actually able to deal with the sine problem, at least in principle, by using a so-called reweighting procedure, in which one basically just takes that complex phase part of the Boltzmann weight and absorbs that into the observable and only uses the absolute value of the Boltzmann weight as a probability measure. But in the process, in order to get the actual value of the observable at the end, one has to divide by whatever that average phase is in order to get to the observable. And in this case, that average phase ends up being e to the negative 50. So even if you were going to go do the reweighting procedure that helps you in principle, you need to be able to resolve e to the negative 50 first in order to accurately get your observable. So this is really a bad situation to be in. This is where we hope that quantum computers may be able to help us out. The idea here is that one, instead of working with gauge field configurations, is going to prepare some wave function and act on it with unitary operations and do measurements on some final state wave function. The unitary gates that are acting on the state are going to be interpreted as some time evolution operator with the Hamiltonian of interest. And if what we're interested in doing is simulating a non-perturbative gauge theory, which takes us to gauge theory on the lattice, that means we're now talking about Hamiltonian lattice gauge theory. The general problem then that we're trying to solve or deal with is how do we map that Hilbert space of the gauge theory and its Hamiltonian onto qubits and gates in some quantum device. So this has been a subject of major interest, especially in the last decade. We're certainly not the first group to try to deal with this. And so here I just have a sort of representative sample of some of the important works that have taken place over the last several years. But in particular, one that I want to draw attention to is one that Christine Mushik was involved with, this real-time dynamics of lattice gauge theories with a few qubit quantum computer. This was the first test of principle demonstration on a digital quantum computer of realizing some abelian gauge theory. In this case, it was the Schwinger model on a few qubit trapped ion quantum computer. So what I'm going to be talking about is Hamiltonian SU2 lattice gauge theory and discuss the geometry that we particularly tried to simulate, which ends up looking like this sort of Plaquette ladder. I'm going to go through the mapping to qubits that's involved with simulating this geometry and theory. And finally, go through some recent results that we got by mapping it onto the IBM Quantum Experience, their 20-qubit Tokyo chip. So in Hamiltonian lattice gauge theory, what does that look like? Well, the length variables that we had from the classical theory are now just matrices of operators. Gauge transformations on the lattice work the same way that they always did. Some length variable gets transformed on the left by some matrix omega, on the right by some matrix omega dagger. And in particular, we have these quasi-independent left and right transformations that we can do on the length variables. So since we have these two different kinds of transformations, there are going to be generators for multiplication on the left and multiplication on the right. The generators of gauge transformations on length variables are in fact electric fields. So that means that we have left and right electric fields to be working with on these links. In this case, we're in some SUN gauge theory. These generators have to obey in this case, it's going to be an SU2 Lie algebra, given that they generate transformations in SU2. Both the left and write generators separately obey that, and the canonical commutation relations amount to these relationships here between the left and right electric fields and the operator or the link operator matrix. As for a Hamiltonian, the Hamiltonian is going to be, just like it would always be in a pure gauge theory, a sum of an electric and magnetic term. In this case, the electric term takes the form of the Casimir operator on all of the links. So this is just a contraction over the color indices here. And then the magnetic energy is familiar from classical lattice gauge or classical computing lattice gauge theory, with the main difference being that these plaquette operators are now only spatial plaquettes. The time-like plaquettes essentially got integrated out in a sense, and that's where the electric energy came from. So that's a quick rundown of just the operators that are involved in describing Hamiltonian lattice gauge theory. But what about a Hilbert space? Well, here there are two obvious kinds of bases to work with. One would be just using a coordinate-like basis, which diagonalizes the link operators. In this case, you have a state for every group element, and they diagonalize these link operators with eigenvalues that are given by Wigner D matrices. There's also a momentum-like basis that's conjugate to that, and in this case, that diagonalizes the electric field operators. The way that these states are labeled is by an EREP of the gauge group. So here, some angular momentum J. This can be any integer or half integer spin. Along with J3 quantum numbers associated with rotations on the left and the right side, which commute with each other. So these give three good quantum numbers for the states on a link. And then the E3 operators are diagonalizing each side, as well as the quadratic Casimir, and the left Casimir and right Casimir are in fact equal, which means that there's no ambiguity in what you mean by electric energy. That eigenvalue is then just J times J plus one. A generalized Fourier transform takes you between these two bases by virtue of these Wigner D matrices. Now, the Hilbert space isn't simply just the tensor product of all of these local link Hilbert spaces put together, but instead one has to also work with Gauss law constraints. In this case, or what that means is that, well, we take any one of these generators of gauge transformations, which is this expression, div E minus rho equals zero, and we have a color component for the Gauss law operator. So this constraint here that these generators annihilate physical wave functions is a constraint that applies at every site of the lattice. What that means then is, since we have a constraint at every site of the lattice, that we have an exponentially small in the volume fraction of basis states in the Hilbert space that's actually allowed. And much of this Hilbert space is a gauge variant disallowed space. What would it look like to try taking this basis and simulating it in practice? Well, the first thing one notices is that truncation really is not ideal for a qubit register representing those states. See this? You can just take these JM and prime states and put some maximum EREP cutoff, call it capital J, and then add up all of the states that are available with that truncation. The dimension of each EREP is 2J plus 1 squared from each of the two M values running over their range. And then if you add up those dimensionalities through all the J's up to your capital J cutoff, you'll find that the local dimension of Hilbert space on a link is equal to this expression. And this is not some power of two. So qubits are going to have to do something funny with some leftover states that you would have to be excluding from the Hilbert space by hand, basically. You can't just include part of an ERET because that wouldn't be a gauge invariant prescription. Additionally, there are non-commuting constraints on the superposition wave functions that you're constructing. So here the point is, one's going to be generating wave functions through time evolution that are, of course, superpositions of the basis states, and yet they have to be annihilated simultaneously by all the Gauss law generators. Yet these Gauss law generators generically don't commute, so they're not simultaneously diagonalizable. So you're in this funny situation where you can't have a basis that diagonalizes all the generators at the same time, yet your physical wave functions do have to all be annihilated by each generator. So there's sort of this subspace on which those generators are simultaneously diagonalized. Another issue is that we just know there are far too many degrees of freedom being carried around with 3 quantum numbers per link. And so this is really an ugly kind of thing to be dealing with in practice for a quantum programmer. To make some progress on this problem, we tried to find the simplest but interesting geometry that we could work with. In this case, what we looked at is a pretty much a periodic string of plaquettes, or essentially just a ladder, which I call a really 1.5 dimensional. So it can be extended in one direction arbitrarily long. So that's the sense in which it's 1D. But we also have plaquettes, which ordinarily only appear in 2 or 3 spatial dimensions or more. So in that sense, we get that feature from 2 dimensions in this geometry. A useful feature of this geometry is that all of the vertices happen to be 3-point vertices. And it turns out that if you choose some collection of Casimir eigenvalues on all of the links, say, entering this vertex, then there's a unique singlet combination associated with that choice of J's that you've made. So that allows you to make a unique association between a gauge invariant state and some collection of the Casimir quantum numbers. So to start giving some names to these objects, we call the Casimir quantum numbers along the top just J superscript T's with an index for our position along the ladder. Similarly, J sub B or superscript B's for the bottom rail of the ladder. And we just call the angular momenta on the vertical links Q to distinguish them. And then having specified some collection of these quantum numbers, it's possible to just write down in closed form what the unique gauge invariant state is that's associated with that collection of angular momenta. And that looks like this. This is a somewhat busy expression, but it's really just expressing something simple. We're summing over all the basis states of this ladder, where we've fixed the collection of Casimir quantum numbers here. And what we're summing over is all of the J3 quantum numbers. In particular, we're contracting them in such a way that we're using Clebsch-Gordan coefficients at all of the vertices, with this expression here being a product over all of the staples in this ladder, and these Clebsch-Gordans forming gauge singlets at the top and bottom vertex associated with that staple. So we're just using simple angular momentum addition. We just have many, many places to form gauge singlets at. By the way, if anybody has questions, you're welcome to interrupt me while I'm going through. As for looking at what the Hamiltonian matrix looks like, well, the non-diagonal parts are the parts that are interesting from the perspective of quantum simulation. And these are derived from the plaquette operators and the magnetic energy. And those are themselves derived from the link operators. So to start looking at what the Hamiltonian matrix looks like, you need to know how a link operator acts on some basis state. And what that action is this link operator basically does angular momentum addition by a half unit on one of these states. So this summation over EREPs here labeled by capital J is just the EREPs that you can get by adding angular momentum a half starting from this lowercase j, which of course is just little j plus or minus a half unit. And then the particular weight that comes with those two, with those states is again given by Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So having the gauge or all of the gauge invariant states enumerated for any collection of quantum numbers and knowing how the magnetic energy works by the action of these link operators, one now has all of the information that they need to compute the actual matrix elements of that one is worried about simulating and ignoring to a large degree many of those spurious degrees of freedom that were there from the start. So when one goes to do that exercise, one finds that the matrix elements of one of the Plaquette operators isn't only a function of the J's going around the links that that Plaquette operator is acting on, but the weights that are associated with the Plaquette operator are also functions of these neighboring angular momenta values. And this is easy to see just due to the fact that the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients that are required to form a gauge singlet are going to be different once you start changing what these neighboring J values are. Another property one notices is that there still are some disallowed states. One expects that there are still going to be disallowed states due to the fact that the Hamiltonian can still be described locally, and one does not expect to be able to both remove all of the redundancy of the gauge theory while maintaining local interactions. What are those disallowed states? Well, I haven't put any restrictions yet on what kind of angular momenta I would like to choose for the lattice. Of course, if I were going to go to some vertex though and say put down 1/2 unit of angular momentum on each of the three links entering that vertex, well, I can't form a gauge or I can't form a singlet by adding three spin halves together. So that's going to be an example of a state that's not actually allowed, even if we're representing it in our basis. We asked how we could actually use this to our advantage. And what we said was, well, the action of the Plaquette operators on that disallowed space, even though we could compute what it is because we know how link operators act, that action is really arbitrary in terms of the physics that we're interested in, because that's a forbidden sector of the Hilbert space anyways. So what this leads us to do is form a what we call a gauge variant completion of the Plaquette operator, which means we go to construct a Hamiltonian matrix, or really the matrix of the Plaquette operators, only worrying about making sure that it has the correct matrix elements between the states that are allowed, and we leave its action between disallowed states either to be vanishing or arbitrary. Moving towards an actual simulation, we need to choose some truncation scheme. And so here we're going to just go with the smallest interesting cutoff that's available to us. In this case, that's going to be just a half unit of angular momentum on all of the links. And then we go through that exercise that I was just discussing in the previous slides of looking at what the Plaquette operator looks like between the allowed states. As an example, the Plaquette operator could be acted on the strong coupling vacuum, the state which has zero electric excitations everywhere. And a state that can result from that would just involve raising the angular momentum by a half unit going around that plaquette. There's actually a symmetry involved here, or to make sense of this notation, there's actually a symmetry that's being used here that's particular to this cutoff. When the cutoff is this value of just a half, it turns out that if one wants to start in a sector that's connected to the strong coupling vacuum, then any state that can be visited by the Hamiltonian turns out to actually have the J's running across the top being mirror images of the J's running across the bottom. So that means that these states that I'm acting on only actually have to be labeled with this cutoff by the quantum numbers, say, along this top portion here. So that's what these quantum numbers are indicating. And then these three halves here corresponds to raising the angular momentum on all of these links here, but we're only showing these three quantum numbers. One can then go through that exercise with all the other allowed states, or one can just generate all the allowed states in this fashion. And then these turn out to be all of the non-vanishing matrix elements between the allowed states. At that point, one can start talking about representing this with a quantum computer, and we just make the simple identification that the zero angular momentum state on a link will just be identified with zero, and then we'll identify the half angular momentum with the one computational basis state. With that identification, and by examining this table long enough, one can see that a suitable description of what the action of the plaquette operator is given by this expression here. So these pi's are just projectors onto my zero or one computational basis subspaces. For example, to understand this term here, you can look at the action of the plaquette operator, again, on the strong coupling vacuum, since that's what, or since the projection operators here will be non-vanishing on that state. And you see that the intermediate zero values that would be along these quantum numbers here end up getting flipped in transitioning to this state, and that the weight of that flip is one. And similarly, you can just look at that same action in reverse. And so you can associate that action with a poly X operator acting on all of the intermediate links or quantum numbers here. So that's why we have these operators here that are just serving to flip the computational basis state. And then going through a similar exercise, these projection operators just continue picking out a particular portion of this table and then describing the action of what the plaquette operator does. And it just turns out to be a bit flip on all of the other links that aren't being projected onto. And then the weights are given by whatever those matrix elements are supposed to be. So we've picked a particular cutoff, angular momentum a half. As for a particular volume, now the smallest that we can use would be a length two lattice. In this case, we get one further simplification. So the first simplification we had was the top and bottom symmetry, but now we also have the fact that our periodically wrapped lattice only has one sort of neighboring plaquette due to the periodicity. What that means is that the quantum number that previously would have been sitting over here relative to this plaquette is now just identified with the quantum number on the left. So we're, instead of working with five quantum numbers when describing the action of a plaquette operator, it's only going to be four. We only have four active links. So we only need 4 qubits to represent that state. And we can go back to the original Plaquette operator and construct that truncated Plaquette operator for this system by just crossing out those terms that would have been projecting onto different subspaces for the qubit that's now being identified due to the periodic boundary conditions. And the leftover terms are our gauge variant completion of the Plaquette operator, given our cutoff and our volume. This little cartoon here is just showing how the Plaquette operator at any either given Plaquette operator only changes the values of 3 qubits, but its action is a function of what the neighboring angular momentum is. Thus, these different weights on these two terms, depending on what, say, this qubit state is. Moving towards time evolution, now that we know what the Hamiltonian looks like in terms of qubit operators, what we use is time evolution by Trotter-Suzuki approximation. So what this means, or what this involves, is taking some time step by the time evolution operator and separating it into individual steps associated with different terms in the Hamiltonian. First, we separate out the electric energy from the magnetic energy, and then further separate out the magnetic energy into its contributions from the two Plaquettes. And then if we want to propagate over a total time t, we can spread that time t over just a single Trotter step, which is going to be the coarsest thing we could do, then to 2 Trotter steps, et cetera. And we would like to be able to do as many as possible. And for a particular state that we're going to start with, we just use the simplest one, that being the strong coupling vacuum with vanishing electric field. So as far as a circuit that will do that for us, well, we can figure out what that is by taking, I'm going to look at just the circuit for the Plaquette operator because that's the interesting non-diagonal part. So to figure out what that is, one can just take the qubit representation of the Plaquette operator that we worked out in the previous slides and interpret that as being controlled operations acting on the qubits. And so here we have one of those factors with a weight of 1 sitting in the exponent, and then the other one with a weight of 1/4. And then we have the 2 different controls here. So the action of this time evolution operator of the Plaquette will be acting on these 3 qubits. And the particular action that these 3 qubits receive depends on which state this J is in, just like this picture was indicating before. Then one can take the projection operators and convert those themselves into Pauli operators. And then in that case, one eventually ends up seeing that there are just 2 independent rotations that need to be implemented. So for those that aren't familiar, this is a quantum circuit notation here. There are Hadamards appearing, which in the computational basis look like this. And then there are controlled knots appearing. These act on a state with a control qubit, say here. And what will happen is that if this control qubit is in the state 1, then it will flip the state of this target qubit. And then the only other gate that's involved is Z rotations, this being the Pauli Z operator. And the particular values that are associated with that are given here as a function of the propagation time. Importantly, this circuit doesn't introduce any further systematics. This circuit is a direct representation of this, and so we didn't have to go through any approximation to get from the theoretical Plaquette operator to a circuit representation of it. And because our plaquette operator that we created doesn't couple any allowed states to disallowed states, that means that our trotterization, and we're realizing it without systematics, that means that our trotterization respects the gauge constraints on the allowed subspace. So it's not going to create any issues there. As for interpreting in the data, what we get out when we go and put this or do this simulation on IBM is probabilities of finding the various computational basis states after having run the time evolution. To extract anything useful out of that, first we have to go through some error mitigation techniques. The first thing to do is do our best to try to correct for the fact that measuring the qubits is not the most reliable process. There are errors that can be introduced when measuring some computational basis state. It may be in zero, but you find it to be in one, and there's a certain rate of errors that are going to be associated with that. So the first thing that we try to do is learn what those correlations are. We prepare all the various computational basis states using just a single qubit operation or single qubit operations. And then we go and just measure it immediately afterwards. And then we see how often we actually get the state that we were supposed to get out and how often we find some other wrong state. Knowing what those correlations are and knowing some output probability distribution, we can use Monte Carlo optimization to take a guess at what the probability distribution would have been were it not for our measurement errors. The second step that we can take is try to mitigate noise that's introduced by controlled knots. So in near-term quantum devices, these entangling two-qubit gates are expected to be the major contributors to noise in the simulation. And so these are really the first place to go try to mitigate noise. The product of two controlled knot operations is supposed to be just the identity operation in theory, but of course in practice with noisy controlled knots, this is going to introduce extra noise into the simulation. We use that to our advantage by going into the circuit and replacing various C-knots in that circuit with now three C-knots. So we've added a superfluous pair of controlled knots and we're adding extra noise. Using that extra noise and the calculation without the extra pairs inserted, we can do a kind of extrapolation down to what the probability distributions would have been if there had been zero noise. Since what we're simulating is a gauge theory, perhaps the first most coarse kind of analysis we can do of that resulting data is to look at how well our wave functions stayed in the allowed space. So we have these survival probabilities here. Oh, whoops. starting with just one trotter step, and this R equals one parameter just saying we didn't insert any extra controlled knots. After we do those error mitigation techniques in the previous slide, we find there's a probability of staying in the physical subspace that's roughly 0.5 or 0.45 for all the propagation times that we considered. We don't have zero propagation time here, but 0.05 is a, or 0.03 is the smallest that we used. Interestingly, there's not actually that much variation over this total propagation time. And it's perhaps important to realize or just recall that all of these propagation times are being translated just into particular rotation angles. So we're not actually propagating some wave function through many discrete times. we're just rerunning the simulation with total rotation angles that are a function of the time that we're trying to get to. When we try to take the simulation to true two trotter steps, so this purple data now going to this darker blue data, we see that there's a pretty big problem. And that's the fact that only 25% of the basis states that are available are actually allowed. And we see that these probabilities are now essentially equal to the probability of just randomly sampling some basis state from the Hilbert space. So we're essentially losing coherence beyond a single trotter step. Nonetheless, if we use the error mitigation techniques here and then do that extrapolation that I was talking about, then that will allow you to get to believed probabilities that are actually on the order of 0.6 or 0.65. So here this extrapolation and controlled knot noise is quite helpful. We would like to do an extrapolation that uses even more C-knot noise, but due to the fact that already at two trotter steps, we're getting down to the saturation level of pure decoherence, there would be no meaning in actually going to one more step. So at this point, this is really the best that we were able to do. Let's see. Extra C-knot noise is indicated by the lighter curves here. So essentially for one trotter step, we were able to mitigate noise significantly. As for an actual physical observable to be getting out of this calculation, we just picked sort of the simplest observable that's available to us, and that's going to be some evaluation of electric energy due to the fact that that's diagonal in the computational basis that we're using. In particular, we're using the electric energy encircling one of the plaquettes. And so after going through all the error mitigation and extrapolations, this is what that value of the electric energy observable looks like as a function of the propagation time. So this purple data is for that one trotter step. And these error bars are just taking into account the kinds of errors that we've attempted to mitigate. What they're not incorporating is, say, single qubit noise or other kinds of two qubit errors. And then the dashed line that's running alongside these data points is what we would expect to see for trotterization if we'd had a perfect noiseless simulation. So this is still discrete because of the fact that we're using trotterization at these various discrete times. And then what this curve looks like if one were to use more trotter steps, say two trotter steps, would be this blue dashed curve. And then the total continuous time evolution operator is this gray curve. Now we see that with the two trotter step data, the points that we get out at the end are actually quite far and totally inconsistent with what we would have gotten from the noiseless simulation. So this tells us that that data is garbage or that we need better error mitigation or more thorough error mitigation if we were actually going to be able to reliably extract an observable for this two trotter step case. And so clearly it's not even worth bothering trying to go to three trotter steps. One other thing I'd like to point out about this is that one could look at these blue data points and say, well, actually that's kind of following the exact answer fairly well. Why is that? Why is it that that looks more like the exact answer than does the one trotter step data? The way that I look at this is the electric energy observable that we're looking at is bounded in this finite dimensional space. So there's a certain range within, or range that its value can fall into. And we're doing a simulation that's a function of a continuous parameter. And so you expect that observable, even if it's being done in a noisy simulation, to at least evolve with some sort of continuity. And so if you have some curve moving around in a bounded range that's continuous, well, it's not actually that hard to get something that looks like a wave out. So to summarize those results from the hardware, this is the first simulation of anything that could be called a truncated non-abelian gauge theory. And this is done on existing IBM hardware that's available to us today. We use the constraints that we know about, that we know apply to a gauge theory, along with tricks particular to near-term calculations to mitigate some subset of errors. And then for circuits that had a low enough depth, namely the one trotter step circuit, we were able to reliably extract an observable using just the error mitigation that we considered in this particular work. Of course, there are lots of generalizations to do for this, for these kinds of projects. The natural next thing to do would be to actually have a higher cutoff. In this case, the symmetry between states that are connected to the strong coupling vacuum, where I had my top angular momenta equal to the bottom, is no longer actually valid. So that means all of the links are going to be active. The gauge variant completion of a Plaquette operator is then going to be much more interesting. It's going to have much more structure to it. We would also like to go to higher dimensions. We'd like to go to true two dimensions, for example, at which point we would have to confront the fact that one doesn't naturally have three-point vertices, okay, at least if you're using a square lattice. We have some ideas for how to render the problem into three-point vertices. Of course, one could just use a honeycomb lattice, or one can do a deformation of a square lattice that makes it topologically a honeycomb lattice, yet the physics that's described by it is still corresponds to a square lattice. In doing so, we would have more qubits and more gates for time evolution, so more noise. So this doesn't look like something that we could do meaningfully today, but hopefully soon. And then the dream, being QCD, would be to generalize this to SU3 gauge group. And a different work that I'm doing with a postdoc at the University of Maryland, her name's Indrakshi Ray Chowdhury, concerns a formulation of gauge theory that's in terms of Schwinger bosons. And we think that this either could be helpful for the quantum simulation, or if nothing else, at least for computing what the Plaquette operator looks like in a more general way, perhaps using classical computing resources. This would allow us to get around having to deal with all of these Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, for example. So thanks for coming to my talk. Thanks for your attention.
So the, I mean, you said hopefully quite soon.
Hopefully soon.
Yeah, in terms of being able to do better things in this era. But I mean, do you have estimates of kind of what error rates you need in order to get something meaningful out?
Yeah. So here. So what was the problem was, just say for two trotter steps, was that we had C knots that were now, where we had now 24 controlled knots, whereas with one trotter step, we only had 12. So we would need to get down, we would get need to get the noise down to the level where say our 12 controlled knot noise is actually comparable with what we might get by putting more controlled knots into it. Actually, I have some of the specs. So the fidelities for the 2-qubit gates on this chip tend to be in or around 95 or 97%. So this is what we need to get, or we would need to get this high enough such that all of these 2 qubits added together wasn't overwhelming noise like we're seeing at this point. But you want to know when?
Well, I mean, obviously you can't tell me when they'll get the upper level, but I guess what I'm, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that you basically keep the error rates low enough so that there are no errors during the run of the computation.
I think it would be a significant improvement if we had 3 nines here, or 2 nines even.
Sure.
We don't even have that for the best 2-qubit gate here. I would expect, but I can't guarantee, but I would expect that if we'd had that, we could have at least done 2 trotter steps meaningfully.
Yeah, but I mean, looking ahead to do computations of a sort where you actually couldn't have done it classically, that's... much bigger computation than do you really need kind of unachievably low error rates for that, or is there something with that?
So I think one part of that is, you know, what kind of observable is it that you're looking at, because different observables are going to be more susceptible to that kind of noise. One could look at something like, say, what was done by Christine Mushik and her collaborators for the abelian gauge theory. There, one of the observables was the mean pair density in the Schwinger model. And that's something that would likely be less susceptible to noise because it's something that's averaging over the lattice. Whereas here, we're actually picking a particular localized neighborhood of the lattice. So those fluctuations are going to cost us likely more. But yeah, to actually get to some observable that we couldn't do with today's classical supercomputers, that looks pretty distant at this point because of just how tiny this problem is and how easy it is to throw a classical computer at this. Here we have a total dimensionality of the Hilbert space that's only 16, and we have 4 allowed states. So I think it's going to be a while before this is actually teaching us something new that we couldn't just get out of classical computers. I would really say.
Yeah, I'm asking even more than that. So suppose we have a quantum computer with a few hundred qubits that you can actually use for this problem, but it's not enough to do error correction and then something. So that's what people talk about in NIST type scenario. But you know, the error rates are still going to be, I don't know, 10^-3, if you're lucky, 10^-4. Can you do a meaningful computation there? I mean, you kind of gave an answer about the different observables, but do you have a sense if that's even going to work?
So if we could get 4 nines, I mean, I think that we could actually start seeing interesting physics taken from that. But we don't really have numerical simulations at, you know, 100 qubits that can assure us of that at this point.
That's the whole point.
Right. Yeah. I personally think that while we may not actually have, like, say, an exact numerical agreement, you know, or okay, it's not going to be exact, but like even some approximate numerical agreement with what the answer ought to be, say with some number of trotter steps and some volume, that we still can get, say, qualitative features out that would be right, like, say, watching how entanglement evolves in some system. You know, we might be off by some certain amount, but the physics that it's telling us about could actually still maybe be accurate even if we have, or at least meaningful, even if we have noisy qubits in the NISQ era. That's what I hope, anyways.
Okay, well, if there's no other questions, let's see it.